I realize when someone asks me to write down our prayer this morning that we use from time to time, that I didn't say this prayer this morning. So maybe we can start right now and say it once again. God, please lay aside everything I think I know about myself, my disease, this book, meetings, and you, God, for an open mind and a new experience in all these things. Please help me see truth.
Okay. Back to page 86 with step 11, and we talked about our instructions for the evening and what we ought to be doing and what we're looking for. And they now talk about on awakening. And one of the things I've been moved to do is literally on awakening, is thanking God for another day and making prayer with God before I get out of bed. And it's a contact that I just been moved to do before I go actually do my prayer meditation. It says, on awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. Because when those motives are removed, it says, under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance because God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is clear of wrong motives. So we're looking at our day and, you know, is my thinking full of wrong motives? Am I thinking clear of wrong motives? Am I asking God to direct my thinking? Am I asking God to direct my thinking in just certain areas and I can handle the rest? It says, in thinking about our day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. So what do we do? We ask God for inspiration, an intuitive thought or a decision. We relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. We are often surprised that our right answers come after we've tried this for a while. And last night I was talking about something that was happening not too long ago to me, and my first reaction was to, you know, get in there and put my hands on the wheel, and I didn't. I remember while I was interacting with others, I made a prayer and I kind of let go of the wheel, and things were working very smoothly without me putting any input into the equation. And it actually turned out to be a very exciting and a promising evening for me. Top of page 87, it says, what used to be the hunch, occasional inspiration, gradually becomes a working part of the mind. And that is the difference between the thinking mind. The thinking mind is always, you know, badgering you over and over and over again. The working mind is what we're allowed to do as we're inspired by God. It says, being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it is not probable that we're going to be inspired at all times. We may pay for this presumption all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. So sometimes we think, you know, God's moving me to do something, and I go do it, and it's really not what God wanted me to do. But I need to take a look at, am I willing to listen to this? Am I willing to follow this quiet voice that I think is moving me? Am I willing? And it's really important here that we're accountable to other people to say, hey, listen, I got this thought, this intuitive thought to do something. What do you think about it? All great spiritual leaders always had people they consulted with. Great teachers confide in others. As a student, I ought to be. I better be. So I run things by my sponsor or people who are close to me. What do you think about this? This is what I'm getting. There's some things going on right now personally with me that I'm getting this feeling in my gut of a direction I ought to be taking instead of the one I thought I had to be on. That's something I need to sit with and meditate on. Really, where am I going with this? But am I willing to follow and grow along spiritual lines? It says, nevertheless, we find that I think it will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely upon it. It says, we usually conclude the period of meditation with the prayer that we be shown all through the day what our next step is to be. that we be given whatever we need to take care of such problems. Page 164 says we ask what we can do in meditation for the man who still suffers. That's one of the things we can do. It says we ask for freedom from self-will and are careful to make no requests for ourselves only. We may ask for ourselves, and here's a condition, however, if others will be helped. We are careful never to pray for our own selfish ends. Many of us have wasted a lot of time doing that. It doesn't work. You can easily see why. And I just want to backtrack for half a sec here. I was talking to a few people during the break about inventory. And what I shared with them is one of the techniques I do, it's a spiritual tool that I work with. With my inventory work with 10 and 11, is we talk about, I use four-column inventory. But what I also include with that is a fifth column. When I look at my fourth column with all the defects of character, all the manifestations of self, in step 11 it says we inquire what corrective measure should be taken. What I did with that was I took that corrective measure and turned it into a fifth column. And again, it's just for me, something that helps me see the way out of the forest. It's just something for me to see the opposite of the defects, the opposite of the manifestations of self, if you will. I look at my fourth column and I see all the defects showing up. And as a tool, what I do is I'll write a fifth column. My corrective measures should be taken. And it's usually just the opposite of what I wrote down in column four. You see that? Dishonest, honest. Suspicious, trusting. Lazy, productive. Things like that. And it just allows me to see, once again, in black and white, maybe what I need to take to God. Because when we know, when we pray about these defects, when we turn things to God, He knows anyway. It's just a humble offering. This is what I think was revealed to me, and I'm offering this to you. He ultimately has the game plan in front of Him anyway. But it's my job to suit up and show up, so I'll use that fifth column. I've been working with it for a long time. Back to page 87. Third paragraph. It says, if circumstances warrant, we ask our wives or friends to join us in morning meditation. If we belong to a religious denomination which requires a definite morning devotion, we attend to that also. If not members of religious bodies, we sometimes select and memorize a few set prayers which emphasize the principles we have been discussing. I ought to talk to you about what my current practice is at this point. I work with my third and seventh step prayer every day. I work with the Lord's Prayer every day. I work with the Serenity Prayer every day. There's a couple other prayers I work with in the morning that are personal to me. My current practice is meditation morning and evening. I was doing three meditation practices a day for a while. One of the things I learned about in this practice is I don't worship the methodology. There was a time where, you know, we had those 24-hour books and all these meditation books, meditation for women, meditation for men over 6 feet tall, meditation. God must be going, what are they doing? Oh, my God, what are they doing? But there's all these meditation books. And so I would have, like, this many books. And I had to read a page out of every one every day. And if I didn't, I would feel like off balance for the day. Oh, no, I didn't read that one, you know. And I sought to worship the methodology. And what I found myself, I remember praying, I'm confused, what do I do? And what I do now is I do what I'm moved to do. And if I move to read, and there's some religious books I work with and some of our AA literature that I work with, if I move to read in the morning, I read, and I'll go 2 or 3 or 4 months reading every day, and then there's times where I don't read, and I don't read. I move not to read, and that's okay. It's about worshiping the power rather than pages in a book. Remember, all these things are pointers to it. I'll work with some prayers in the morning, and then I'll sit with my meditation. I'll do the same thing at night and there's inventory throughout. One of the things we can do is get so tight with this information and the methodology that, as a friend of mine says, we can 11-step ourselves right out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I always say this, we need to go in order to go out. If I don't go in, I will go without. And the third part of that is, if I go in too long, I better look out. What do I mean by that? A friend of mine was in meditation, and he hears his wife calling him from the next room. And he's sitting in meditation, hears her call the second time and the third time, and she's getting louder. And in his meditation, he barks back at her, "God damn it, can't you see I'm meditating?" You see what I mean? So if I'm in my house and I'm going down to, you know, to go meditate, and someone needs help with something, and I say, "Listen, I have to meditate. You're on your own." Or maybe you have children and need to be dressed for school, but you have to meditate, or you get to work 2 hours late because, "Boss, I was meditating. Sorry." That's not what we do. That's worshiping the methodology. So I make time for that practice, and it's very private to me. I usually do it very private on my own. I go into silence like that. Go into silence, go into darkness in order to be here. There's some other things I do with meditation, other practices outside of Alcoholics Anonymous that I do along with, not instead of. But it's great. It's just great work. It's great discipline. And it is work and it is discipline. I would get to a place where if I didn't sit in a meditation for 40 or 45 minutes, I would think I failed for the day. And I was worshiping that. I'm at a place where I do so much time in the morning and so much time at night, and I've even gotten to a place free enough where I do the disciplines, but if I do a 10-minute meditation or I do an hour meditation, and I've done both, I don't feel like I failed or succeeded. It's what is. Now, if I'm around here a little while and I'm doing this practice and I'm still meditating 2 or 3 minutes, maybe I need to take a look at that. But if I show up in meditation willing to be taken to wherever I'm going to be taken, if it's a 10-minute or an hour meditation, that's what it is, and I'm really okay with that. And I've had neat experiences in meditation where I found out through certain experiences coming out of a meditation, as I shared, I think it was Friday night when I was here to speak, that I realized that God knew me. And that was out of a meditation. I've taken questions into meditation. I've just sat quietly in meditation. I've been taken to places in meditation. I sought refuge in meditation. And I don't know what I would do without it, because it's a way of communing, if that's the right word, with my God. It's us, He and I. I always have this great picture that always comes to me, is sitting on one of these little stools, knee to knee with my God, my conception, knee to knee, like father and son. And it's very clear, like I can see you guys, is how I see it very often. And we're knee to knee, and I sit with him like I would with a child with his father, and asking him questions, very comforting, very guiding, very warm and loving. And we always ultimately get up and walk. And we walk and we talk. And I'm this student or this little guy talking to the teacher or the father. And I've gotten great experiences. I'm here this morning because of stuff like that. And I'm allowed to go about in my affairs the way I do, whether I fall short or not, because of that stuff. And I like to think God has made me a much better person over the years, prior to what I was like when I walked in here in 1988. Deep down inside, I don't care how sick the drunk is, there's a spirit, but it's just so blocked, we become ugly. And I like to think a lot of that stuff's been removed because of this. I know I walk with dignity today, and that's pretty neat, because I couldn't bear to looking back at me in the mirror at one time. So getting off the subject, I apologize. Get back to this stuff here. Page 87 on the bottom, it says, the middle of that third paragraph. It says, if not members of religious bodies, we sometimes select and memorize a few set prayers which emphasize the principles we have been discussing. There are many helpful books also, and I've sought out these helpful books. Suggestions about these may be obtained from one's priest, minister, or rabbi. Be quick to see where religious people are right, and I have and still do. Make use of what they offer. I have and I still do. Talks about what to do going through the day. We pause when agitated or doubtful, and here's a prayer. We ask God for the right daughter action. What do I do here? Because I have to constantly remind myself, I, Pete Marinelli, am no longer running the show. Humbly saying to myself many times each day, thy will be done. We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions, and these are all different manifestations of self. We become much more efficient. If I'm not consumed with me, I'm awake to the present moment, I can be efficient. I'm not tired and exhausted. Ask an alcoholic, how are you doing today? Oh, I'm pretty tired. Usually, it's because they've had 80 different roles going on in our mind before we get to the AA meeting. All those things I was talking about, driving down a highway, you got all this stuff hitting you, hitting you, hitting you, you get to the AA meeting, how are you doing? I'm tired. Oh, sure you are. You just had, you know, 20 gun battles on the way to the AA meeting. It says we do not tire so easily, for we're not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. It works. It really did. It really does. We alcoholics are undisciplined, so we let God discipline us in a simple way we have just outlined. But this is not all. Again, they're telling us to move, aren't they? There is action and more action. Faith without works is dead. The next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12. In the discipline of this work, there's great freedom. In the discipline of this work, we get freedom. The more spiritual power I embrace, the less self I rely on. The more self I rely on, the more spiritual power I can embrace. And the last thing I'll leave you with this is, at this point when we hit 10, 11, and 12, the road has narrowed. The road has narrowed. We cannot get away with certain things we used to. But in the narrowing in that road and the disciplines of this work, there's a great amount of freedom. It sounds like we're being cut down, but what we are is being, a lot of things are being removed, and there's great freedom in that.
My name is Tom Needham. I'm an alcoholic. Bottom of page 87, when I first experienced that line, that sentence, it says, as we go through the day, we pause. When agitated or doubtful. The first time I met my friend Mark, he shared what resonated so much in me, and he made the statement, when agitated or doubtful. He says, that's like a constant state of mind for the alcoholic. So if that be, I should be asking for the right thought and action frequently. And I understand that. You know, I understand today. I understand when I work with others. And I can appreciate the compassion, you know, that people have had for me, and people like Mark that would say things like that, that they know where I'm coming from. You know, we're living on this planet. We, you know, like alcohol has beaten us into a state of reasonableness, and we're done. And the solution has been taken away from us. And how do I operate now in this world? And we're giving a set of directions. This book talks about things like we'll get to a place of being happy, joyous, and free. Promises. Happy, joyous, and free. It's considerations. Am I happy today? Am I really happy today? Do I have some joy in my life today? Am I free today? Am I stepping out easy today? Considerations for me. Without the disciplines of this process, and I fall short, but without the disciplines of these steps, this methodology for me. Because I'm a real alcoholic, and I have to tell you, it's the only methodology that's ever worked for me. And I've gone searching for a lot of methodologies, you know. But no one ever sat down and gave me the time to show me. And then someone showed up in my life, and God put this man in my life, and he was used as an instrument to his 12-step became my first step. I can go on about you know, Peter was talking about we are careful never to pray for our own selfish needs. You know, many of us, we've wasted a lot of time doing that, and it doesn't work. And that's basically going back to what I said earlier about, you know, my friend Donnie talks about the alcoholic war cry, you know, where's mine, you know. And I'm always thinking about me. And I've had a tendency to see, you know, where's mine. And, oh, if I had that, well, yeah, you know, I'll rationalize that, and I'm really doing it for my family, you know. But I know in the back of my mind it's resonating to me, and I'm saying, you know, I don't think it really means that. I've got food, shelter, and clothing for my family, for God's sakes, you know. I mean, what else, you know? I mean, what can I give this man? What can I give the man that, how can I help my wife in other ways? How can I help my boy? I shared, you know, like maybe I think last night or I've experienced, you know, like some fear in the last couple of months due to situations in my family life with my boy, and the entire family has experienced the same thing. And I can't imagine how it would have been over 9 years ago. That thought of my even, you know, like, imagining or considering how it has really not, you know, like, it was like a little bleep or a glimpse, and it goes right out because, and I think that is because this is a design, you know, for living that really works, what's happening here. And, you know, like what I have to do here. And I'll fall short in all of these methodologies at times. But I think God knows that my heart is in the right place, I would hope. I think I trust that today. Peter talked about, I think it was last night, that Peter was talking about the monks. And they were asked the questions, you know, of one guy that goes up to the monk and he says, what do you do? And he says, well, I see you do is you eat and you walk. But we know. And my, when I get up in the morning, like Peter, you know, my routines basically change. I'm moved to them. I'm not exactly sure what I'm going to be doing on any given morning today. In the beginning, it was very important. In the beginning, I would have to say for a good 3 or 4 years, you know, I started off, or I ended up, I should say, you know, when we retire at night with that review, and I start off in the morning, you know, reading that paragraph when we are awakened, and then I'll read step 10, and then I would sit. In meditation. Now it's just a matter. I get up. I ask. You know, I know all the words by rote, and they've served me well throughout the years. But I sit, you know, and I consider, and I like to read. You know, teachers, contemplatives. Like for example, I read. You know, like I brought Merton with me to read. I like Merton. Talks about the human condition, the suffering. Okay. And from there, I have to go out. I have to go out. And I have to tell you, I fall short. You know, sometimes I get caught up. Okay. I was going to ask my friend Mark to, you know, like, sponsor me, but Mark is like 3,000 miles away in Texas. Then fortunately for me, Peter comes into my life, and then he gets introduced to Mark, and, you know, so he's flesh. He's with me. He's here. And I've got other friends like Peter around that are close to me on this path. It's important to me to, at least, at the very least, to be aware and awake to that triangle, to knock myself out, and not to beat myself up. Not to beat myself up because I don't follow the methodology. I am not a robot. I'm free. And I trust that he's given me freedom. And the freedom he's given me is to have my constant thought to help others. To have compassion for others like people have had compassion. And I think that's it. I think that's the key. You know, my working with others, that's where it comes from. This contemplative life, this meditative life. So when I get up and I walk, that I know that I'm walking, that I know that I'm watching, and that I'm not constantly in that agitated state, because I can go there like that in a minute. Because I can judge quickly, okay, and I can be asleep to the fact that that man is going through the same thing that I've gone through somewhere along the line. So.
Chapter 7, working with others, which is our step 12. And if you notice, when we go through this, step 12 reads, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, right? But yet in this chapter, they don't talk about having had a spiritual awakening. They get in right into working with others. Because by the time you get here, you've already had a spiritual awakening. Back in step 10, it says we've entered the world of the spirit. We've had it. What are we going to do with it? They talked about growing in understanding and effectiveness. Now we go out and serve. We help others and take these principles into all our affairs. So it says practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure, here's a great promise, by the way, immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. I like you to circle the word intensive. Am I working with alcoholics, and what type of work am I doing with them? Intensive work is not saying, telling your prospect, well, give me a call and we'll talk. We'll meet at the diner next week. Intensive work is about sitting down with another drunk or doing the work over the phone and working with them. On Saturdays, I have four guys I work with call me, and we meet during the week at a meeting. But Saturdays, we do a lot of work. I work with a lot of guys on the phone. That's why it's easy to work with my sponsor on the phone. But we work, and I take them through. God moves us through these steps. And anyone who works with me knows it's going to be work. I was brought up with boot camp AA, and you know, it's what I do. My experience has not been with the sponsor who you speak to once a month and talk about your dramas of life. You can do those things, but it never worked for me. It says, carry this message to other alcoholics. And, you know, what message? The question I have to consider, am I carrying to other alcoholics? It says, you can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they are very ill. Life will take on new meaning. To watch loneliness, to watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you'll want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. It says, perhaps you're not acquainted with any drinkers who want to recover. You can easily find some by asking a few doctors, ministers, priests, or hospitals. They will only be too glad to assist you. And we have lots of people coming into Alcoholics Anonymous who have been here many years who really need our help. One of the things I do when someone comes to me to ask them if I can be their sponsor is I don't sponsor them right from the get-go. There's certain things they need to do first, like I was asked to do. And our book will talk about it. I ask them if they have a copy of the big book. And if they say they do, and if they don't, I'll get them one. I instruct him to go home and read the first 164 pages of this book, the first portion of this book. And on the second visit, I ask them if they're ready to go through the 12 proposals and ready to tell me their story. I ask them if they're willing to go to any lengths to recover also. If they think they're an alcoholic and their lives are unmanageable and do they want help. And after going through that stuff, then I will begin my journey with these people in sponsorship. I also let them know on my very first visit what they're in for, some of what any lens is going to look like. I don't just spring it on them. I sit with them in a few minutes and sometimes longer, depending on who the prospect is, and I let them know what I expect from them and what they need to do out of this book. And I'll do a review of what the 12 steps are going to look like and some of the techniques we're going to be using, some of the tools I ought to say we're going to be using, and the importance of them going out to work with others once they wake up. So when I sit down with them on a second visit and I hand them their first assignment, it isn't like, well, where is this coming from? Many times people want you to sponsor them just because you may be a little bit popular, and then you tell them to go home and read the first 164 pages of the book, and suddenly they don't like you anymore. I let them know that we're going to be speaking on the phone a few times a week, that we're going to be meeting at a meeting. Do they have a home group? Are they serving their home group? You know, what are they doing for others? The thing I've learned over the last couple of years, too, was the importance of taking this stuff home. And if they're lucky enough to have a home, what are they doing in it? Are they spending time with their significant other? Are they spending time with their children? If they're not, one of the instructions I give now, because I found how important that is for me, is to spend time at home. My sponsor has a great term about, he calls it doing the dash. I didn't know what he meant. And it's really simple. When you go to a cemetery on a tombstone or the headstone, there is the date we come into this world and the date we go home to God. And right in the middle of those two dates is a little dash. That's our life. What are you doing about it? What do you do? That little dash is your life. That's it. That you were here with this gift, that I'm here with this gift, that we're here with this gift. What are you doing about it? What legacy are we leaving? That little dash is you. The before date and the after date aren't too important. What are you doing about it? And my sponsor says, are you doing the dash? And I didn't know what he meant. And now I do. It's really, I will tell you, it's a silly little story, but it's a true story. And I can't tell you how important that has become to me. It has moved me to drop belief systems which kept me in bondage for so long to do this deal. Not only in here, but out there. And I've learned recently how to really do this dash and have a whole lot of neat things happen for me. With all the stuff that's going on in my external world, I can tell you, I haven't been happy. I've never been this happy. And if you look at my external world or look at my checking account, you say, what are you happy about? You know, things have dwindled a little bit. I'm really having a blast. Good stuff. Okay. To go over to page 90. It says, when you discover a prospect for Alcoholics Anonymous, find out all you can about him. If he does not want to stop drinking, don't waste time trying to persuade him. You want to stop drinking? And the guy says, well, I don't know. Well, call me when you're ready. You may spoil a later opportunity. This advice is given for his family also. They should be patient, realizing they're dealing with a sick person. Now, a book really gives us guidelines here on how to work with others. You'll see there's a lot of general principles in this chapter on how to work with others. The message should stay the same. The approach to a drunk can change. That's what I have found. Some prospects you balk at, and some you can talk very calmly to. But the message is the same. If there is any indication that he wants to stop, have a good talk with the person most interested in him, usually his wife. Get an idea of his behavior, his problems, his background, the seriousness of his condition, and his religious leanings. You didn't need this information to put yourself in his place to see how you would like to be approached if the tables were turned. It says sometimes his weight till he goes on a binge. The family may object to this, but unless he is in a dangerous physical condition, it's better to risk it. Don't deal with him when he is very drunk, unless he is ugly and the family needs your help. And this is, I found to be so true in my life and working with others. Wait for the end of a spree, or at least a lucid interval. The neat thing about after drunk comes off a spree, they're in that place where you can approach them, where they're broken down. We have this, some of the ingredients that go into having a spiritual experience is first we need to be broken down, where everything has to be removed. We're our sense of self, if you will, is made very, very, very small. And we're in that place where someone can get in and pull us out.
On the second paragraph in the chapter Working with Others, it gives us some promises, as Peter has already read. First promise on that page is life will take on new meaning. New meaning. And I got to watch people recover, to see them help others, and to watch the loneliness vanish because those people are helping others. And their lives, like mine, is no longer any of their business. Like mine is no longer. My sobriety is for you. My sobriety is for my wife. My sobriety is for my kids. My sobriety is not for me. Both Peter and I have had the opportunity to see a fellowship grow up about us on Staten Island. That's a great thing to see. And the excitement, just like the excitement I see here on this weekend with a lot of people, when people are fired up. And it's great stuff.
One of the great things I found out in working with others, our book talks about this too, is baiting the drunk. You know, you meet with a guy outside of a meeting and they're going through dramas of life, but they're just coming off a drunk. And, you know, in your own way, you can say, I know how you feel. I was there too, and I no longer am in that place anymore. And what we do, I found, you bait a guy because we want them to say, well, what did you do? Now you got him. You know, well, can you sponsor me? You got him. I found the approach that does not work with most alcoholics is when they come to you and they open up and they ante up and they put their cards on the table and say, well, you need to do this, that, and the other thing. Bait them first. Put it out there. I was where you at, and I'm no longer anymore. I'm in a different place. They'll listen.
Our friend Joe talks about, we'll do anything to hook an alcoholic. Do anything. And it's great stuff. You know, it's Peter shared about it. You know, there are different approaches. Again, you know, like I trust God, you know what I mean? You know, like let me, you know, keep me awake to this guy while he's in front of me here, and let me see where he's going. Let me see where he's lying. Like Peter said, you know, most likely if a guy's in that condition, if he's moving his mouth, he's probably lying, you know. And, so I got to sense something beyond that. I better have spirit, you know. but there are different ways, you know. And there are different conditions, you know, where this guy is coming from. Does this guy need power now? I mean, we all need power now, you know. The way it was shared with me, you know, I was in tough shape. The man that carried the message to me, he realized, you know, I was 4 days out of jail and I was about to take myself off the planet. I didn't have time to read 164 pages. I guess he sensed that. You know? But he gave me something. You know? And so there are different approaches. I sort of like the best approaches, you know, like being in my home group and the one I'm most comfortable with. You know, like I'll share something at the meeting or a man will see, you know, something in any one of us, you know, they want what we have. Just sit down with a man and go to a diner. We have diners in Brooklyn and Staten Island. I don't know if you have them over here in Denmark, but we have, where you can go for a cup of coffee or a coffee house, you know, cafe. Sit down, have a cup of coffee, and just try to make the man feel welcome. And that shouldn't take very long if you'd be a real alcoholic, and you're a real alcoholic, and you're sharing this message, you know. Because the book talks about winning the confidence. You know, just make the connection. I'm very sensitive to the idea that I come from a thought like my great grandsponsor Donald say, if I raise my voice, I'm wrong. I like to just say, hey, not taking action, not doing the deal. Okay. Like I shared last night, there's a man out in Colorado. He talks about, you know, I care, but I can't care unless you care. You know, and that caring shows up in taking some action and following some directions. And I'm not going to ask a man to do something that I haven't done. So life takes on new meaning.
Before we continue reading, I think it's important we talk about our 12-step calls and how we're doing that and if we've ever done any. I've had the privilege of being on just a whole bunch of 12-step calls. I've taken with others guys to detoxes in hospitals where I've gotten sick in my car, just made a shambles in my car. I've gone into homes. You ever do a 12-step call on a drunk and you go into the home? You walk into the house and the house looks like the drunk. It looks depressed. It looks dreary. It looks run down. It looks dirty. And the family is suffering from alcoholism and they're not even drinking. And usually you take the drunk out to a detox or to a meeting, and the wife is doing one of two things, my experience has been, is take him, get him out of here. Or the other thing is they're in such fear, she's in such fear, it's back to, is he going to come home tonight? And she's depending on us to take care of her loved one, who she may be really, really, really angry with at the moment and wondering what happened. Then you work with that drunk, and you watch them wake up. And you go back into that same house just a few months later. Not only is the drunk made new, but the house looks different, and the wife is different, and the children are different. The house is different. There's a different spirit in the house. You see it. Walk into a drunk's house and walk into a sober house. It's different, two different things. And I've experienced that, and that's been a privilege for me to see in my own eyes how people wake up, and when we take this awakened spirit back into the place that we damaged so severely. You know, the wife has a new dress on, the house is painted, the kids are playing. I mean, it's just a different deal. They're just going about their business, no longer in fear of the old man coming home drunk again. And what's it going to be? Who's going to cover up? Who's going to patch up? Who's going to fill in the holes? Great stuff. I've also done many 12-step calls where, you know, I drop the drunk off at the hospital at 1 o'clock, and 2 o'clock he's back on the corner again. And I wondered, how did this happen? I would take a drunk to a detox, and they'd be drunk as soon as they got out. And I always felt like for a long time that I failed, I did something wrong. And I didn't. We don't. We're doing the deal. We're not responsible for that outcome. We are responsible for what we're presenting and what we're doing here, but many times drunks get drunk on us, as many people took me away, and I got drunk, you know, 20 minutes later. I've even done a few 12-step calls all alone in my car because there was no one around. I made prayer, and I took drunks to a car, and it was interesting. One guy was afraid of getting violent, and I'm not a violent person. I don't even really walk around angry. That's not my disposition, I guess is the word. But I was barking at this guy because I was afraid of him getting violent, taking a wheel, going over this bridge in Staten Island. And I had to have some discipline in the car. I had one drunk sitting in my car, insisting on driving on to the detox. He couldn't even hold a cigarette. I told him get rid of the cigarette because he was going to burn himself, but he insisted on driving, and then he wanted me to take him for a shrimp dinner before he went into detox. And that got pretty interesting in my car. You know, I've had some humorous things happen to me in 12-step calls. I've even had awkward situations where anytime I do a 12-step call with a woman, I always take a woman with me if I get a call, or I give it out to two other women in AA. And I had one experience where a woman was supposed to meet me at this door and go into this house to get this woman out of there. No one was there, and the parents invited me in. And I was there alone, and this woman was really fired up. And, you know, she had other intentions of what I was there for. And that became very awkward for me, and I was very, very uncomfortable about it. It's not what I do. Someone else may have taken advantage of that. And, you know, I had to make some calls to AA Intergroup and sit tight until they got someone down there and take over. So I've been in situations that are kind of sticky like that and uncomfortable. But I'm always willing to put myself on the firing line and get in the trenches. And I found out that God will keep me safe and protected in those areas, even if I visit, as our book says, the most sordid spot on earth. And you want to know something, and I don't mean any disrespect to Alcoholics Anonymous, but sometimes a sordid spot can be right in the room, meeting room of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because many times we're thinking, okay, I have to go out there and get the drunks in here because they're dying out there, and many are dying right in here and don't even know it. Page 90. It says, when you discover a prospect for Alcoholics Anonymous, find out all you can about him. If he does not want to stop drinking, don't waste time trying to persuade him. You may spoil a later opportunity. This advice is given for his family also. I want to skip over to page 91 now. Second paragraph. It says, see your man alone if possible. At first, engage in some general conversation. After a while, turn to talk to some phase of drinking. Tell him enough about your drinking habits, symptoms, and experiences to encourage him to speak of himself. Bring yourself down to the drunk. Get where he's at or she's at. If he wishes to talk, let him do so. You would thus get a better idea how you ought to proceed. If he's not communicative, give him a sketch of your drinking career up to the time you quit. And here's the bait that I was talking about, but say nothing for the moment of how that was accomplished. If he is in a serious mood, dwelling with troubles, look at his cause, you being careful not to moralize or lecture. If his mood is light, tell him his humorous stories of your escapades. Get him to tell some of his, get him to ante up. When he sees you know all about the drinking game, commence to describe yourself as an alcoholic and tell him how baffled you are, how you finally learned that you were sick. Give an account of your struggles you made to stop. Show him the mental twist which leads to the first drink. We suggest you do this as we've done it on a chapter on alcoholism. If he is alcoholic, he will understand you at once. He will match your mental inconsistencies with some of his own. If he's a real alcoholic, he'll know what you're doing. Dr. Bob said about Bill, he spoke my language. Now, here's something I've experienced over the years. It says to me, if you are satisfied he is a real alcoholic, begin to dwell on the hopeless feature of the malady. I've sat with people who said they were alcoholics, who wanted me to sponsor them, and I listened to their story, and I was not convinced they were alcoholic. And I can hear it. And I had struggles in working with people like this. And one gentleman told him, I'm not convinced you're an alcoholic, and I'm not going to be able to work with you, and I had to let them work with someone else. I've had things like that happen too. I've had one gentleman, I don't even think he's an addict or an alcoholic. I just think he needs to be in therapy. Spiritually lost. I've had crackheads come to me, swear they're alcoholics, and hear their first step is their first step assignment. And they picked up two beers in their entire life. They've been smoking crack for 10. How do you qualify yourself as an alcoholic? One gentleman got so angry with me, he was strictly a heroin user. Had maybe a half a beer in his entire life, but was in Alcoholics Anonymous relapsing and relapsing and relapsing, saying he was an alcoholic, living a lie, trying to build a foundation on truth based on a lie. And I sat with this guy, and I said, you're not an alcoholic. There's no allergies, no obsession, nothing. What you are is a pure heroin addict. I said, I think you need to go to Narcotics Anonymous. That would be your home. Come to some of our open AA meetings. Well, he didn't talk to me anymore. But not too long ago, I saw him, and he drove up in one of these big pickup trucks and jumped out of the car, and he said, I'm looking for you. And I says, uh-oh, here we go. Pissed off another one. And he got out of his car with all these medallions they give in that fellowship. And he came over to me, and he thanked me, as angry as he was with me at the time. And he told me how angry he was with me because he went to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting on a resentment to prove me wrong. And he heard the speaker share, and he totally identified with it, and he realized I was right. And he was home there, and he was clean a long time in that fellowship now. And he says, my life has never been better. And he says, I've been looking for you just to thank you for that. Now, I could have been one of those AAs, say, bring everybody here. No matter what your ails are, come here. And they keep relapsing because there's no identification. So am I convinced that this prospect is a real alcoholic or not? And I need to lovingly give them truth and let them find the answer. And I've done that a few times. And this was just a success story with this one guy.
If a man or woman is ready, in other words, they've been beaten, you know, that alcohol has been beaten them to the state of reasonableness. My friend Joe shares it this way, that there's not a hell of a lot that you can say that's wrong. Because he's done, or she's done. And they're willing to go to any length, and you can sense that. For the time that you have them right in front of you, they're willing to go to any length. We'll see down the line if they continue with, you know, like taking action. But if a person isn't ready, there's not a hell of a lot you could say that's right that's going to get them to that place. So I have to be, you know, like I have to try to be awake to that in terms of, you know, I just have to, like, move on. I have to move on, or I have to stay, and I have to sit with this man, and I have to see him alone, you know, as opposed to, you know, like having the family around, although there have been situations, you know, where, you know, the family has asked me to, like, intervene, and I just don't come from that place. I mean, it has to be the man himself. I believe that it's a good idea that, you know, men work with men and women work with women. There's a guy by the name of Paul Emmett. He's out of Chicago. He's plus 50 years sobriety. And he says that if you do it like that, that'll go ahead and save a lot of inventory by the time you get to inventory. I've had great experiences with working with others. People stay the path. That's the important thing. We were talking about it last night during the question and the answers, and you know, like Dave was talking about it. The biggest problem with Alcoholics Anonymous today is that people are coming in, okay, and it's like that bucket, and there's a hole in the bottom of the bucket, and it just keeps on going through. I showed up at my friend Marianne's anniversary a couple of years ago, and I shared for her and a group in Brooklyn. And there had to be about 100 people there, and five, if that, I knew, you know, from maybe about 15, 20 years prior. We're into, I guess I'm digressing a little bit, but I'm thinking about to have people stay. And to have people stay, they've got to do the whole deal. three sides of that triangle. Okay. And it's vital. We were talking about it with my friend before. It's vital. It's a must to keep on doing this, to keep on helping others. And you just don't do it just for the sake. I mean, it's true when they're talking about the promises that life will take on new meaning. Okay, it will not only be new, it'll be interesting. Things happen. Strange events, you know, like when you're doing 12-step courses, Peter shared. But with that. So.
Got page 92. Second, third paragraph. It says, continue to speak of alcoholism as an illness, a fatal malady. Talk about the conditions of body and mind which accompany it. Keep his attention focused mainly on your personal experience. Explain that many are doomed who never realize their predicament. From there, let's flip over to page 94. With me? First paragraph. And this was what I was talking about earlier about setting up what's in store. Outline the program of action, explaining how you made a self-appraisal. Step 4, how you straighten out your past. Steps 8 and 9, or you're now endeavoring to be helpful to him. It is important for him to realize that your attempt to pass this on to him plays a vital part in your own recovery. Actually, he may be helping you more than you are helping him. Make it plain he is under no obligation to you, that you hope only he will try to help others when he escapes his own difficulties. Suggest how important it is that he place the welfare of other people ahead of his own. Make it clear that he is not under pressure, that he needn't see you again if he doesn't want to. You should not be offended if he wants to call it off, and many people have called this off with me. For he has helped you more than you have helped him, and I have, and they have. If your talk has been sane, quiet, and full of human understanding, and I've seen people whose responses have just the opposite talks with their prospects. And I wonder what's going on with that. Sane, quiet, and full of human understanding, because I'm awake, it doesn't make me better than anyone. You have perhaps made a friend. Maybe you have disturbed them on the question of alcoholism, and this is a great thing. Am I shaking you up to wake you up? Because they did with me. This is all to the good. The more hopeless he feels, the better. He will be more likely to follow your suggestions. Your candidate may give reasons why he should not or she should not follow all of the program. He may rebel at the thought of a drastic house cleaning, most do, which requires discussion with other people. Do not contradict such views. Tell him you once felt as he does, but you doubt whether you would have made such progress had you not taken action. On your first visit, tell him about the fellowship of AA. If he shows interest, lend him a copy of your book, and this is what I was talking about. Page 95. Third paragraph. If he's sincerely interested and wants to see you again, ask him to read this book in the interval. After doing that, he must decide for himself whether he wants to go on. He should not be pushed or prodded by you, his wife, or his friends. If he is to find God, the desire must come from within. So I loaned him a copy of this book. I asked him to do the reading. Page 96 talks about what to do when they don't respond. Do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You are sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you have to offer. We find it a waste of time trying to keep chasing a man who cannot, will not work with you. I've done that. A dear friend of mine in Staten Island, who thank God is sober now, I've done that. And what happens is I miss the people knocking on my door to get in because I just want this so much for you. And if you don't want it, there's nothing. If you're not interested in this, how could I help you? I need to move on to the next drunk. If you leave such a person alone, he may soon become convinced that he cannot recover by himself. So we raise the bottom in a sense. To spend too much time on any one situation is to deny some other alcoholic an opportunity to live and be happy. One of our fellowship failed entirely with his first half a dozen prospects. He often says that if he continued to work on them, he might have deprived many others who have since recovered on their own. Suppose you're making a second visit to the man. He has read this volume and says he's prepared to go through the 12 steps of the program of recovery. Having had the experience yourself, you can give him much practical advice. Let him know you're available if he wishes to make a decision and to tell his story. But do not insist upon if he prefers to consult someone else. Page 97. Someone asked me about the stones and the cement earlier. And he asked what the foundation stone was. Page 97 says, first paragraph, second sentence. Helping others is the foundation stone of our recovery. A kindly act once in a while isn't enough. We have to act a good Samaritan every day if need be. The following paragraph talks about, you know, the inconveniences we think we may experience when it's the middle of the night and the phone rings. When you're watching a ball game and it's, you know, getting down to the wire and the phone rings and it's another drunk. I'm a big basketball fan and I remember watching a playoff game at home. And I had my brother over with his wife, and I was there in my living room, and the game was great. We had dinner, and the phone rang, and someone says, Pete, Lou the Butcher is in trouble, who's no longer with us. He died because of this. Can you come down to the neighborhood? We need to take him to a hospital. And my first reaction is, now he had to get drunk? But I knew I couldn't stay in that house, and I had to let everyone know where I was going. They were understanding, and I went down there, and we got this guy. He was in really, really, really bad shape, and he was beat up. We had to call an ambulance. We got him off to the hospital. And I was really okay with doing that. And those are the things we do sometimes. 12-step work for me has been really one of the bright spots of my life, one of the many bright spots of my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I always feel it. That the prospect is always doing more for me than I can give to them, because all I'm doing is passing on information and my experiences to them. So I'm very grateful to be able to do that and working with others. And the neat thing is my phone rings. It rings and rings and rings, and it's a good deal. What I've learned how to do with a lot of help from my sponsor is how to take those calls. Because if you start to listen to everyone's drama of life and don't get to the bullets, you'll never be off the phone, and you'll start to miss the pleasures of your own home. And I've learned how to do that, and that was difficult for me. Sitting down with a prospect, they want to share. What is an alcoholic about? Selfish and self-centeredness. So let's not talk about you. Let's not talk about me. Let's talk about you. What do you think of me? And so they talk and they talk, and we need to learn how to get to the bullets of what's going on, causes and conditions, when we're working with others. My book on the bottom of page 100. Many times we'll hear, you know, I can't go to this place because liquor is being served. Well, let's see what our book says. Assuming we are spiritually fit, we can do all sorts of things alcoholics are not supposed to do. People have said we must not go where liquor is served. We must not have it in our homes. We must shun friends who drink. We must avoid moving pictures which show drinking scenes. We must not go into bars. Our friends must hide their bottles if we go into their homes. We mustn't think or be reminded about alcohol at all. Our experience shows that this is not necessarily so. We meet these conditions every day. An alcoholic who cannot meet them still has an alcoholic mind. There is something the matter with his spiritual status. His only chance for sobriety would be someplace like Greenland or Greenland Ice Cap, and even there an Eskimo might turn up with a bottle of scotch and ruin everything. Let's skip down two paragraphs. It says, so our rule is not to avoid a place where there is drinking. Condition is if we have a legitimate reason for being there. And that includes bars, nightclubs, dances, receptions, etc. Okay. You will note, it says in the next paragraph, that we have made an important qualification. Therefore, ask yourself on each occasion, have I any good reason, any good social, business, or personal reason for going into this place? Or am I expecting to steal a little vicarious pleasure from the atmosphere of such places? If you can answer these questions satisfactorily, you need have no apprehension. Go or stay away, whichever seems best. But be sure you're on solid ground before you start and that your motive in going is thoroughly good. Do not think of what you will get out of the occasion. Think of what you can bring to it. But if you're shaky, you had better work with another alcoholic instead. If we skip down to one paragraph. It says, your job now is to be at a place where you can be of maximum helpfulness to others. So never hesitate to go anywhere if you can be helpful. You should not hesitate to visit the most sordid spot on earth on such an errand. Keep on the firing life with these motives and God will keep you unharmed. And that is a tremendous promise, isn't it? Many of us keep liquor in our homes. We often need it to carry green recruits through a severe hangover. Some of us still serve in our homes, provided they are not alcoholic. But some of us think we should not serve liquor to anyone. We never argue this question. We feel that each family, in the light of their own circumstances, ought to decide for themselves. We are careful never to show intolerance or hatred of drinking as an institution. Experience shows that such an attitude is not helpful to anyone. Every new alcoholic looks for the spirit among us and is immensely relieved when he finds that we are not witch burners. A spirit of intolerance might repel alcoholics whose lives could have been saved had it not been for such stupidity. We would not even do the cause of the temperate drinking any good, for not one drink in 1,000 likes to be told anything about alcohol by one who hates it. Someday we hope that Alcoholics Anonymous will help the public to a better realization of the gravity of the alcoholic problem, but we shall be of little use if our attitude is one of bitterness or hostility. Drinkers will not stand for it. After all, our problems were of our own making. Bottles were a symbol. Besides, we have stopped fighting anything or anybody. We have to. And I'll let Tom do the closing remarks here this morning. I'm just going to close with something from a vision for you. And before I do, I thank you really sincerely on behalf of my girlfriend, also Linda, from the bottom of our hearts for allowing us to be here. And I think I speak for Tom when I say that also. This has been really a really just a neat event, and I appreciate so much of the questions and your enthusiasm about this is work sitting in here for 3 days. It's work. Wise man said the mind can only stand what the butt can stand, and you guys have been here, and it made it easier for Tom and I to do this. And maybe, God willing, we can get back here one day and do this deal again. But in closing, if you guys can flip over to page 164 in the second paragraph, it says our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact to us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and we shall surely meet some of you as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Page 102, I'd like to just reemphasize the third paragraph. It tells me what my job is now, today. It's to be at the place where I can be of maximum helpfulness to others. So never to go anywhere if I can be helpful. The connotation in this is the next line. You should not hesitate to visit the most sordid spot on earth and such on such an errand. And I keep on the firing line. I think the firing line for me sometimes is my state of mind. That place, if I'm not awake. If I'm not awake to the fact that what's happening, okay, if I'm not experiencing something, that happiness, that joy, and that freedom. If I don't have these spiritual tools to take me through this bump in the road that I'm going to at the moment, okay, I'm useless. I'm really useless for the next person. It's the way it was shared with me. You know, it talks about the 12 step in the short form. It says, we carry this message after having a spiritual awakening and these practicing these principles in all our affairs. And that line, you know, speaks tons for, you know, like that, my idea of this idea of me being of maximal helpfulness to others. Peter, I don't know if he, you know, like I missed it, if he did, but there's a, specifically when we're talking about alcoholics and working with them, as a guy, one of the first tapes that the man that carried the message to me gave me was this guy Ken, and he talks about on page 95, in the middle of that paragraph, There's a pretty heavy direction. And it says, never talk down to an alcoholic from any moral or spiritual hilltop. Never. Ken goes it this way. It's a, you know, he takes the word never, and he wants to know what part of never don't we understand, the ne or the ver. But he does say, it goes on to say, show him how, I'm sorry, simply lay out the kit of spiritual tools for his inspection. For his inspection. Ebby showed up with Bill. Bill had a half a load on. Something was going on. Spirit was moving. Bill got the message. All Ebby did, in a matter-of-fact way, was just lay it out. And he let Bill know how they worked with him. And he offered Bill friendship. And it's my job to offer friendship and fellowship. And let this guy know, or this woman know, that if they want to get well, we'll do anything to help. Anything to help. Thank you.
Thank you.